This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
Shocking. Absolutely shocking. That they have taken away our right to have reasonable restrictions. We can have restrictions on speech. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. But somehow there's no restrictions allowed on the Second Amendment.
That is Kathy Hochul, the accidental governor of New York City, reacting to today's huge and I would say positive Supreme Court decision. A win for the Second Amendment, a win for the firearms rights of every citizen, which have been under attack lately, if you haven't noticed. And we're going to talk about that for a bit. I invite your phone calls. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. So welcome to the Lars Larson Show. And if you want to sound off, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our Twitter poll. We'll get to that in a moment. It has to do with red flag laws, another attack on the constitutional rights of Americans. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. Now, about that Supreme Court decision, Kathy Hochul says, why, you can't have any limits on the Second Amendment. That is actually factually wrong, and she knows it's wrong, or maybe she's not bright enough to actually understand it. We keep explaining to the confused liberals and progressives what the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution actually means. And the folks in New York passed laws that clearly violated the U.S. Constitution, and that's what the Supreme Court decided today. Our God-given rights include the right to own guns. Can government put some limits on the actual exercise of that right? Kathy Hochul is right. You can't shout fire in a crowded theater. There can be limits on every one of the Bill of Rights, and anybody who says otherwise doesn't know constitutional law. Because if it weren't true, you could go out and say things that would incite a riot. And yet virtually every city in America, including New York City, has a limit on free speech. It's a law called inciting to riot. It can be a crime if you're charged with it. It isn't charged very often because it doesn't happen very often. But the anti-gunners try to say that the Second Amendment only covers a militia, and that ain't true, and the Supreme Court has said so, or that only the guns in use when the Constitution was written, and that isn't true either. In fact, if you could hold all of the constitutional rights to the standards when the Constitution was written, then it only talks about free speech and free press. There was no TV, there was no radio, there was no internet back when they wrote the First Amendment. And yet the First Amendment does apply to the modern versions of free speech. Or that they say only the guns that our government masters deign to allow us to have. Well, unarmed people are subjects. Armed people are citizens. Over the last 20 years, the Supreme Court has helpfully provided some clarification of the limits the Second Amendment puts on the government. Just remember, the Second Amendment is not a grant of rights. It is a limitation on what the government can do to take away our God-given rights from citizens. Well, just hours ago, the court issued its latest missive to America's rabid anti-gun activists. New York City tried to tell citizens that they could only own guns inside their homes. That is wrong, and the court now says so. In the Big Apple, if you are not rich or politically connected or both, you can't get a gun carry permit. So effectively, New York City was saying, Own a gun if you want to, a pistol or a rifle, but don't take it outside your house. Is that what keep and bear arms actually means? The Supreme Court sensibly said, no, that's not what it means. It also means that poor people, including a lot of people of color, then the most likely group to fall victim to criminals, could not protect themselves. That's what New York City was saying. Today's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court ends all of that. The Supreme Court says you have a right to carry a gun outside your home. In other words, to keep and bear arms. The mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, reacted with hyperbolic rhetoric. Listen to this.
We work together to limit the risk this decision will create once it is implemented. And we cannot allow New York to become the Wild Wild West.
The risk of becoming the Wild Wild West? You got to be kidding me, Eric Adams. Arming law-abiding citizens threatens to create a Wild Wild West? I'm thinking that arming the law-abiding poses a threat, all right. It poses a threat to every dirtbag criminal out there. Criminals like the ones in Chicago and New York and other cities around America who know that most of the law-abiding in at least the big blue liberal cities have been disarmed. That makes them easy pickings for the bad guys. If all of a sudden the good guys, the law-abiding, are armed, well, if the bodies of criminals start to pile up on the streets of the formerly anti-gun cities like New York City, I would have to say that's a good start. Now, let me give you some pieces of the decision, because once again, Justice Clarence Thomas, one of the 6-3 majority in this decision, he had it dead on. He said that New Yorkers who want to carry a license or get a license to carry a handgun in public have to show proper cause. In other words, you've got to show that your life's already been threatened before you can go get a permit. Generally, it means in New York City, you have to be very wealthy and very politically connected. As Thomas wrote, when the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual's conduct, the Constitution presumptively protects that conduct. The government must then justify its regulation by demonstrating that it's consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearms regulation. The Supreme Court decided New York City's rule was not. And in another opinion in which Kavanaugh and Chief Justice Roberts agreed with Justice Thomas, they said the ruling does not preclude some state and local regulations. Some regulations, gun ownership by felons or the mentally ill, or banning the carrying of firearms in sensitive locations. As Roberts and Kavanaugh wrote, properly interpreted, the Second Amendment allows a variety of gun regulations. States can make applicants apply for a license. They can undergo fingerprinting, a background check, a mental health records check, training in firearms, and laws regarding the use of force, among other possible requirements. And yet, this craziness of saying you just can't get a permit unless you're Michael Bloomberg, a rich guy and a politically connected guy, or other rich and politically connected people in New York City. Paul Clement, the lawyer for the group that brought the lawsuit, said his clients were looking for nothing more than what their fellow citizens in 43 other states in America already enjoy. Carrying a firearm outside the home is a fundamental constitutional right. It is not some extraordinary action that requires an extraordinary demonstration of need. Can you imagine if I got called into court and said, hey, Lars, before you say all those words on the radio, you have to get the government, get a permit from the government. Oh, and by the way, you have to show a need to have to say those words before you can exercise your First Amendment freedoms. Or imagine the government saying to you, you need to go to church on Sunday or synagogue on Friday night or Saturday. No, you have to show us you need it before you can actually exercise your rights. Can you imagine anything so crazy as that? Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
Brought to you by Handyman Maintenance Remodeling. You can find them at hmrservices.net. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
I just kind of wonder out loud, why doesn't Seattle's police chief stand up and tell the LGBTQ community how very wrong they are? The Seattle Pride Parade, which is coming back this weekend in Seattle, is coming back this weekend for the first time in 3 years. And the Seattle Police Department will provide the crowd control. They'll respond to emergencies. They'll do control of intersections so the parade can happen. But the gay community has apparently given a big middle finger to the police department. They've said, we don't want your cops marching in our parade as they have before, because we don't like some of the past interactions with the police. And I think the LGBTQIA plus community may be talking about things that literally happened decades ago. Here's what they wrote: as a show of respect for the community, which has experienced much trauma at the hands of uniformed cops over the long history of criminalization of queer people, they're disinviting the cops. So what does Adrian Diaz do, the interim police chief? He's been interim for more than a year. In response, he said, this has been met with sadness by members of the SPD because they have 100 LGBTQIA plus officers, commanders, and civilians. Why doesn't he say this is wrong? The anti-cop attitude, and now being pushed by a part of the community that I think I could say arguably has needed the services of the police more than other demographic groups in particular, and now they're giving a big middle finger to the cops? That doesn't make sense for me. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Rogue Conveyors. Go Rogue.
Well, I gotta say, almost everybody has noticed the price of fuel, diesel, and gasoline going up dramatically. You know what else has gone up? The cost of mortgages. It went from about 3% at the end of 2021 to over 6%. And who did that? Well, I would say Joe Biden has pushed that. The inflation, the increases in costs, the massive government spending. So as a result, the headline this week was 168,000 households just in the Portland area have been priced out of buying a house. And I could say, well, I feel sorry for those people. I just want to ask how many of those people voted for the very guy who drove these bad changes that have now priced them out of the home market. That's who gets the Daily Grill today. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small, collision or paint repairs. Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Austin writes in, Lars, so I was thinking about the Putin price hike, and I came to this conclusion. When the Biden administration is saying this, are they trying to say he has more power over the U.S. and its economy than our own government? Well, there is no they. It's Joe saying it. Because if they're insinuating that all this inflation is due to Putin and there's nothing they can do to blunt it, then does that mean we're no longer the largest financial powerhouse on the globe? I'm not sure which thought is worse, Putin being able to control the U.S. economy, according to Biden, or the elected officials in the U.S. being unable to control inflation. Now, I want to get to a story that I think is hugely important, but I haven't seen it anywhere else except on KTVZ, which is a television news operation in Central Oregon in Bend. They quoted JT Taylor, who joins me now. He owns a couple of shops, including Strictly CBD, and you can find him online at ancientcannabis.com. Mr. Taylor, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad to do it. So you're in the business, just so people know, you sell CBD and hemp. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And I own a USDA organic processing hemp processing plant here in Redmond.
So you make edibles and things like that, and you're regulated by the OLCC, the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission, and you have to follow their rules and regs.
Well, we were regulated. I guess we're now jointly regulated by ODA, which is what we are currently before July 1st. And as of July 1st, now we're regulated by ODA and OLCC.
Now, you called out a change in the laws that goes into effect a week from tomorrow. And as a guy who sells hemp, but you sell it, you're allowed to sell hemp products to people who are underage as well. You called out this change because, if I'm not misunderstanding what you've said, you're saying that the ODA and the OLCC have actually made it legal to sell intoxicating levels of THC in products to people who are underage. Is that a fair summation of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, intoxication is open for interpretation, but yeah, what the law is now going to allow is up to 0.5 milligrams of THC per serving. But, you know, you can put, 5 milligrams in 10 gummies and eat 20 gummies pretty easy, and you got an intoxicated kid, and they're going to look at you and they're going to say it's hemp. Well, in my opinion, you can make hemp products without intoxicating levels of THC in them and sell it to kids. It's just, you can't do it with THC.
I just appreciate the honesty of a guy who's in the business and you sell to adults, but saying if you make these changes, you'll be able to sell products that kids are going to find out fairly quickly they can buy, even if they're underage, that will get them intoxicated, right?
Yeah. And then on top of that, the other one that's a concern is that now every gas station in Oregon is going to be able to sell up to 2 milligrams of THC per serving and 20 milligrams per container. So they're allowing and then also be labeled hemp. So, you know, it's confusing to a consumer who would think they'd be eating hemp, which is intoxicating already. And then an hour later, you're intoxicated because you ate 10 gummies, and that's 20 milligrams, and that's a dose of, you know, that's a legal dose of THC. So it's going to be confusing to a consumer because, you know, you can't smoke enough hemp to get high, but now you can eat hemp to get high. So I don't know how they can justify that.
One last quick question. I said we're going to have you back another time, but this is JT Taylor from Strictly CBD in Central Oregon and ancientcannabis.com. Did the OLCC know that it was effectively legalizing intoxicating THC sales to minors when they did this?
I've reached out to them over the last couple of weeks once I started hearing about these rules and, you know, voiced my concern. And basically they just, look at me like I'm crazy and like, it's going to be fine. And I'm like, okay, well, now you're hanging your hat on this. You know, if there was ever any question of what's legal and what's not legal, you're now hanging that hat on your liability.
Absolutely right. That's JT Taylor from Strictly CBD. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. My friend Kevin Mannix, the attorney, the president of Common Sense Oregon, business attorney, former chair of the Republican Party, ran for governor as well. Kevin, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Lars. How are you?
I'm not doing too badly. So you've been in court against Kate Brown. What's the result of all this? Because you were seeking to make the case that the governor was acting a bit like a queen of the state.
Well put. We had a one-hour argument, which is an unusual amount of time, before the Oregon Court of Appeals, three judges this morning. And I was first defending our victory in circuit court, where the circuit court said that Kate Brown cannot give extra jurisdiction to the parole board to reduce certain sentences. And so we were defending that against the state, challenging it. But then we're still calling on the courts to issue what's called mandamus, a mandate to the governor that she must follow the clemency statutes and let the district attorneys and the victims be heard when she's reviewing each clemency case. So we presented our argument to the Court of Appeals today, and we'll be standing by waiting for a decision from them. So we're still in the fight.
Now, if you win in this case, because Kate Brown, she had some complicated gyrations the way I see it. She said, I want to give clemency to all these people, but then I want it to look as though the parole board is somehow involved in the decision, when the right of clemency is the right of a governor and nobody else. If you win, you got a partial victory in the circuit court, and you're asking the Court of Appeals for a full victory in this case. If you get it, what happens?
what happens is the governor has to follow the process of the law. And if she wants to be granted clemency in each case, she needs to gather up all the facts, notify the district attorney, allow the victim to be involved, hear their comments, have all of that presented under the record, and then she has to wait 30 days before rendering a decision. It's a processing, and I'll call it due process, as to clemency. And she's the only governor since 1864 when they passed these laws who hasn't followed this process. And it's important because that means she has to be gathering the information and reviewing it, and she doesn't get to hand it off to somebody else or the parole board. And
okay, but Kevin, you left something out. Decision. The way I heard it, you left something out. You're talking prospectively. She has to do that from this point forward. What about the people she's already cut loose from prison, including killers? Do you have to go back with those and redo those and reconsider their release and haul them back into custody? Or is there any fix for the ones she's already done?
I'm going to be careful about my answer to you because in this case, we're asking that she be told she has to follow the law. Once we have a decision that she has to follow the law, we'll be evaluating what we can do about the old cases.
Well, and when we say old cases, we're only talking about the last few months, right?
Correct. And what I'm being careful here, Lars, because the way we've set this case up, it's only for right now mandamus telling her she has to follow this process. Once we've established that, we get to go back and evaluate the effect of her failure to follow the process in the past.
Well, can I?
I'm being a lawyer, Lars.
I know you have to. And I'm not a lawyer, thank God. But if you get a win, if this court of appeals says, okay, you win, she has to follow the law, is there likely to be a case to be made that some of the people already released will have to be brought back?
Let me put it this way. One could certainly make such a case. I'm parsing my words because I am the lead lawyer in this litigation.
Okay.
And I don't want folks to, I don't want to twist around things for the current litigation, but we've certainly looked at the bad things that have happened and what can be done later to clean them up.
Okay, because Kevin, you understand one of the biggest frustrations for citizens that I hear about all the time that I express frustration about is saying, well, when we catch the government actually doing something wrong, is there a, to use lawyer language, is there a remedy? Is there a fix for it? And fixing it from this point forward is part of it, but fixing what they've already done, especially if they've done it not decades in the past, but months in the past, should be within the reach of the law, shouldn't it?
Yes, it should be. And the way they handle that would be in a separate case. And right. I'm going to be careful and not say much more, but you're on track, Lars.
Okay, because you and the partial victory you got from the circuit court, would you mind describing that for my audience? What did the circuit court say you were right about?
And it's been upheld on appeal so far. And the circuit court cannot be given jurisdiction to shorten sentences where they didn't have jurisdiction before. The governor tried to give them the authority to retroactively look at those who were under the 18, who were age of 18, who were sentenced for violent crimes, and to give them a chance to shorten those sentences on their own. And the circuit court said and agreed with us, she can't do that. She cannot give jurisdiction to the Board of Parole where they don't have jurisdiction. She can't delegate her clemency powers. So that is still in place. And the parole board is not able to hold a bunch of hearings to reduce sentences for people who were duly convicted and sentenced in the past and whose it's truth in sentencing. Those sentences are still in effect.
Can you take off your lawyer hat for a moment, put your politician hat back on, and I'll ask one that I think is within. Okay, Kevin, why does anybody in government right now think it's a great idea to cut loose convicted criminals and send the message to other criminals that we're dramatically reducing the penalties for doing things that hurt people? Why does anybody think that's a good idea?
The only people who think it's a good idea, in my opinion, are a minority of people who don't get it, who don't understand that accountability is important, that justice is important, and that incapacitation is important. Because these violent criminals, they're the worst of the worst, and they're the ones that are going to do it again. And when you release them early, you're putting everyone at risk. Now, so I have find it hard to explain the mentality of these folks who take this position because the majority of my fellow citizens don't take that position. They apply common sense And when someone rapes a woman or assaults someone else in a bar and stabs them in the back or murders somebody, they've done terrible things. They're predators. They need to be held accountable for the protection of society. And releasing them early eliminates truth in sentencing, which we established back in 1989, and then we strengthened it with mandatory minimum prison sentences for violent crimes, My Measure 11. And crime went down for 10 years straight because the word got around that if you did bad things, you were going to be held accountable. And now the message is, hey, do drugs. Measure 110, which was a false advertising in terms of how it was presented to the voters. We have a whole problem now where the message is, hey, do a crime and don't do the time.
And Kevin, by the way, I don't know if you caught what was on right before you came on. I just talked to a guy who's in the hemp business. He makes CBD. He also makes hemp gummies. And you say, well, those are legal to sell to kids. Apparently, the OLCC and the ODA have made it effectively legal a week from tomorrow to start selling intoxicating levels of THC in hemp to underage persons in Oregon.
That's incredibly stupid.
I would say so, too, because what is the state going to do? We've legalized hard drugs for adults, effectively legalized it, de facto legalization, and now we're going to legalize getting high.
$100 fine is legalization, as far as I'm concerned.
I think it is legalization. Oh, no, not at all. But, I mean, I've been telling, and they say, well, it's not full legalization. It's still a violation. I said, yes, it's a violation for which you get a ticket that you don't have to pay. So, you know, it's like it's a distinction without a difference. That is Kevin Mannix, attorney, president of Common Sense Oregon, and former chair of the Republican Party and one-time candidate for Oregon governor. Coming up in a moment, a lot of you like our Jim Gossett parody guy. He's got an offering in honor of the J6 committee, and I'll get to your phone calls and emails in the next segment. And if you run from the cops and they tase you, is it excessive force if you fall and hit your head? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
There's no trial like a show trial, like no trial that I know. Everything about it is deceiving. The January 6th committee lies. A bunch of crap that no one is believing. The tales they're weaving, nobody buys. There's no people but Joe's people who'd fall for this lame show. Adam Schiff's a liar who's been caught before. Kim Zinger is a major bore. Liz Cheney won't be in the Congress anymore. Cause this trial is for show. Yes, this trial is a show.
That is the great parody artist Jim Gossett on the Lars Larson Show, and your phone calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. By the way, of course, that song was about the January 6th committee. It turns out the committee has discovered that almost nobody is paying attention to what they're saying, and what they're saying is having almost no effect at all because it's mostly a retread of information that we have known since the events of January 6th of last year. So the attempt to make hay about what happened, well, the lies continue. They say that cops were killed. No cops were killed on January 6th. No cops died because of the incident on January 6th. The only person murdered that day was Ashley Babbitt, an Air Force veteran of 15 years who was murdered by a Capitol cop, but he was never charged, and he has been cleared of any wrongdoing whatsoever, which should tell you that the fix is in. Well, guess what the latest development is? The January 6th committee now says they're going to put press the pause button. They were planning to have more of their so-called hearings, this dog and pony show, where no one chosen by the Republican side of Congress was allowed to be on the committee. They only got the rhinos like Kinzinger and Liz Cheney and the like, all chosen by Nancy Pelosi and her Democrat bunch, who are going to lose their majority in the House this coming fall. Well, Benny Thompson, the chair of the committee, told reporters yesterday The committee is going to hold off on its two final hearings that it had planned for this month. They say, we've taken in new information that's going to require additional work. So rather than present hearings that have not been the quality of hearings in the past, we made a decision to just move into sometime in July. Can I give you a translation of that? They're going to move them into July, and then they're hoping, I think, that when Americans go on vacation, if you can still afford the gasoline, by the time you get back in August or September, they'll be able to simply move along and put all this mess behind them. To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's start with Bob. Hey, Bob, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, I have a little comment, maybe a little backup here to what the Supreme Court did today about concealed weaponry. And I want to tell you that I never owned a firearm till I was 71 years old. I never felt unsafe. But I traveled to Portland a lot to see my family and going on there. So at 71 years old, I went out and I bought a gun. I bought a firearm. And I got my concealed weapons permit. And like a responsible citizen, I went, paid a good sum of money, and was professionally trained to use it.
Good.
And I firmly believe that, you know, that it's our right to do that. I think that we do need to protect ourselves in this day and age. I mean, in Portland, you have a police force that's, you know, down on so many officers, you know, and spread very thin. I live in Salem. I feel very safe in Salem. But I have to tell you, Lars, when I visit Portland, I'm carrying my concealed weapon. It's only for my protection, and I hope to heck I never, ever, ever have to use it. But I've been trained properly, and I'm going to protect myself.
I got to tell you, Bob, I have nothing against training. What I don't want to see is the government say to us, well, you have to, this is what New York City was telling its residents, you have to prove that you need a gun. And they wouldn't just say, in fact, there were great examples where people would apply for a concealed carry permit who, say, were diamond merchants down on, I think it's 47th Street in Manhattan. And they'd say, look, I'm carrying $1 million worth of ice with me every day. Can I get a gun? And they'd say, no. And basically, they wanted you to either be well-connected politically, have a pile of money, or prove that you had already been assaulted and lived through it. And then you could say, now I have a reason. Having people justify that they have a reason to exercise a Second Amendment right is just wrong all day long. Now, if they want to say, we want to check and see if you're a felon or if you're a domestic abuser or if you've been to the crazy house by order of a judge, yeah, you can be prohibited from buying a gun. But once you meet all those qualifications, if you're a legal owner of a gun, to keep and bear arms, the Constitution was never written to say you can only engage in free speech in your home. You can only exercise your religion in your home. Nor does it say you can only own it, you can own a gun, but you can only own it in your home. And now the Supreme Court has made that abundantly clear. And you've got people like Kathy Hochul and Eric Adams of New York who are saying, oh, my God, it's going to be the wild, wild. A lot of those same predictions, Bob, were made back when concealed carry was legalized in Oregon with a permit system. There were people, some of them I know well, who said it's going to be a disaster. There's going to be a shootout at every fender bender. And you know what? A lot of those people are honest enough to say we were completely wrong. So thank God for today's Supreme Court ruling on guns. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. And we'll do that at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in our Twitter poll. We made this, I wrote the Twitter poll before the Supreme Court's decision today. Should elected county sheriffs refuse to enforce red flag laws? As you know, that some of the members of the Congress are going to vote for a bill that is going to push states to adopt red flag laws. Well, we've already got at least some sensible people saying we're just not going to enforce them. You can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And when I see things going on, either in meteorology, in climate change, or in this case, on the sun, the guy I have to call is my friend meteorologist Chuck Weiss, airline pilot as well as a trained meteorologist. Hey, Chuck, welcome back to the program. I knew you were the guy to talk to about this solar flare that we're hearing about. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks, Lars. Glad to be here.
So what do we know about this thing, and is it a reason for people to be concerned?
Right now, I'm tending to think that we don't have to be concerned. But as a word of caution, I would say that the predictability of the sun is not a perfect science by any means. But the history of these types of flares that can cause problems with our communication, electric grid, that sort of thing, they normally occur when we are nearing a solar maximum. In other words, the upside of any one of these solar cycles that we go through every 11 and a half years. And right now, we're at a minimum, just starting cycle 25. So being at the minimum, the sun is a lot less active in respect to producing a class X or X10 flare, which are the worst kind, especially if they're accompanied by the coronal mass ejections that come out of them. And those are the ones that can cause enormous amounts of disruption and damage. But right now, we're at the at just starting cycle 25. So and there's a lot of B and C stuff going on in the sun right now, but those are the least active or least intense of the flares out of the five different classifications. There's A, B, C, M, X, and up to X10. And an X10 to an A, that's a million times more of the energy. So we're a long ways off from that with what we see going on now. And the likelihood of getting an X that's pointed right at the Earth that would do something like that is probably not very high. But that's not to say that we don't have to be concerned about this. I wish we would do something more to protect the electric grid, because the Carrington event, which a lot of people have heard of, some don't know about it, but there was a guy by the name of Richard Carrington that lived over in London back in 1859. And he happened to be, he was mapping a cluster of sunspots at that time and happened to see a massive class X10 flare on his telescope. And he didn't know what it was or the significance of it, but it was directed straight at the Earth. And that Carrington event caused enormous disruption in communications back then. But, of course, there wasn't near the electrical equipment, satellites, any of that stuff in orbit or on the ground at the time this thing happened. But the telegraphs that they used back then, the wiring heated up, caught fire. The communications were completely disrupted. Aurora Borealises were visible from the North Pole all the way to the equator. It was quite an event, and where the auroras were showing up, they were so bright it would actually light up the Earth just like it was near it, like twilight and half light outside. So that was a very significant event, and if we did happen to get one of those with all the communications and the power lines that we have now, the damage potential is very high.
Well, Chuck, let me ask you. One of the concerns I've told people about is EMP, electromagnetic pulse. That's what we're talking about, because if it affected telegraph wires, which are, you know, wires you can actually see with your eyes, what kind of effect would something or could something like that have on circuitry that runs everything around us, all these integrated circuits where the conductors are, you know, fractions of the size of a human hair? I mean, they're almost invisible to the eye. Does it have the potential to do damage to those kinds of circuits?
Oh, it could do enormous damage. If the circuits are in use at the time the flare hit the Earth, they could do enormous damage to almost any kind of circuitry. But the power lines on the grid, those are going to pick up that kind of radiation and amplify it many times because of the length of the wires that go into these substations. And so you could cause enormous damage there. And the smaller circuits could get affected as well. So it's not something that you can ignore, but the downside to it is if you don't do anything to protect yourself ahead of time from stuff like this, there's not going to be any warning, because when Carrington saw his event in 1859, that was September 1st, 1859, by the time he sees that on his telescope, it's too late. The radiation is already arriving with the burst of light that he saw. And so it would be a similar type of thing here. If you could pick this stuff up off the sun before, right at the time of origination, you'd have an 8-minute window to do something. But the radiation is often, it's not detectable till it gets right on top of the Earth. So that's why you need to be protected against this kind of stuff ahead of time. I'm not overly concerned about it, but when you think about the potential for damage, if it ever did happen, it would be enormous in today's society because of the satellites that are in orbit and all the communications equipment on the ground from that, the wiring on the ground, and the power lines. They're all very susceptible to those types of things, whether it's a EMP attack from a nuclear weapon or the sun acting up and throwing out a class X10 flare with a coronal mass ejection. That's what happened in 1859.
And this thing is called AR-3038. Apparently, they spotted it between Sunday and Monday. It got bigger. It's several times wider than Earth's diameter, and they said it's still expanding 48 hours later. But there's really no way of predicting how big it's going to get, but it appears to be on the side of the sun so that it's actually pointed right in the direction of Earth?
Well, that's what some of these news articles said, yeah. But when I go into space weather right now, there's nothing really significant going on. It's all C and D and C stuff is what you see on there right now. And that's the insignificant amount of things that only radio operators pay attention to, but they're not really that disruptive either. So we're in good shape right now, as long as we don't have one of these things suddenly erupt on them. But when you look at the history of them, they tend to occur more at the solar cycle peak than at the trough or the minimum, which we're just coming out of. So if you play by those rules, you wouldn't expect to get something that devastating right now. But they also tend to occur when the solar cycles decrease in strength at the peaks. And one of the things that concerned solar physicists back in 2000 and got my attention was when they started saying that in cycle 23, they started seeing a change in the magnetic fields and a bunch of other parameters that they look at on the sun, and that made them think that we might be headed towards a Dalton or a Moder minimum, which could affect our weather patterns. And that always interested me, so I started studying it. And so far, their predictions are not too bad. However, cycle 25 is starting earlier than projected, and the earlier they start between the minimums, the more likely the following cycle is going to be more active. So 25 may be stronger than what they originally predicted, but it doesn't mean that we still aren't headed towards one of these minimums. We'll just have to wait and see where 25 peaks, which is supposed to be at the year 2025.
That is meteorologist Chuck Weiss, also an airline pilot and very knowledgeable about global warming issues, anthropogenic global warming, and, of course, sunspots as well. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go first, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. And today's Twitter poll, should elected county sheriffs refuse to enforce red flag laws? I believe there are some county sheriffs here in the Pacific Northwest who've already done this. But one of them that's notable around the country is Tony Mace. He's the Cibola County Sheriff in New Mexico. The state has a red flag law. And he said, look, I'm not going to enforce it. And I think that's a sensible thing to do. He said, they made this bill so horrible, we cannot enforce it. Somebody hasn't even committed a crime, and you're taking their personal property. He identifies exactly the same issue that many of us have focused on, and that is, you've got the U.S. Congress right now that appears to be on the cusp of passing a gun bill. And for some reason, a bunch of Republicans have jumped on board and said, hey, we're going to help the Democrats pass one of their big holy grails, and that is a gun bill, because the Democrats have had nothing but failure for the last year and a half since Joe Biden took the oath of office as president. We've had inflation. We've had massive increases in fuel. The mortgage interest rate has more than doubled. We're now sending tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine. We had 13 service members killed getting out of Afghanistan. We gave the Taliban tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons. I mean, nothing has been going the Democrats' way, which makes me wonder out loud, why are the Republicans handing this victory to the Democrats on a bill? Basically, the bill that's 80 pages long before the Congress right now does three major things. It closes what's called the boyfriend loophole. And as far as I can tell, there isn't a single mass shooting that's been tied to somebody getting through the boyfriend loophole. So it's you're saying we're going to pass a rule because we're going to throw anything we can and the kitchen sink at the wall, to mix up metaphors a little bit, and see what sticks. You know, they didn't get a ban on semi-automatic rifles. They didn't get a ban on this, that, or the other thing. So they say, well, let's pass whatever we can get passed. I think the Republicans should have told them to pound sand. Say, we're not voting for that stuff. You guys want to walk yourself over the edge of a cliff and tell Americans that you don't support the rights of law-abiding citizens by passing more laws that are only going to affect law-abiding citizens and will not affect the bad guys at all? In fact, in today's Supreme Court decision, literally one of the justices said, you're trying to argue that having these rules, like the ones on whether or not you can carry a gun outside your house, is going to make a difference. One of the three major mass shootings in the last couple of months was in Buffalo, New York. So it was under the very law they're talking about. And of course, the killer in that case wasn't affected one bit about being able to walk out of his house with a gun and take the lives of American citizens. So when I see a sheriff saying, look, somebody who hasn't committed a crime, somebody who hasn't had a court hearing, somebody who hasn't had due process, you're going to walk in and take their personal property. The sheriff in that county in New Mexico just says, I'm not going to enforce that. So that's on the agenda today. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, all you got to do is, well, you can vote in the Twitter poll. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Should elected county sheriffs simply refuse to enforce red flag laws? I'd say yes to that. And yesterday's question, should public schools lock up their sports fields so the public cannot make use of that public property? 84% of you joined me in a no vote, but surprisingly, 16% of you said yes. The public schools should take those public lands and lock them up behind a fence paid for by the taxpayers so that the public is not allowed to use the public land. Now, if that one makes sense to you, I'd love to hear the naysayer argue that point. Let's go first to Jason. Hey, Jason, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, I got something of a conspiracy theory. Okay. I think they should give the president a no-confidence vote. You know, he's really he went to Saudi Arabia to try and get an oil increase, production increase. They should have sent Trump. He's got a better relations with the royal family.
Can you think of a good reason for Donald Trump to bail out Joe Biden by doing that? Even if Joe Biden could get past his own pride and ask Donald Trump to do it, I think Trump would tell him, stuff it. You made this situation. You own it now. You broke it. You own it.
Well, Trump, he still has a voice, even with all. With
no,
all
he's got a voice, but why would he help the guy who screwed things up so badly and tried to erase everything Trump did that was good for America? Can you name a single thing? I mean, as the Democrats are heading into summer, the real campaign in earnest for the general election begins after Labor Day. But Jason, when we get to Labor Day, which is only a couple of months away, what are the Democrats going to point to and say, we got that done for you Americans. This is a good thing. Can you think of a single thing they can point at?
Not really off the top of my head, but I had another point I wanted to make in conspiracy-like.
Go ahead.
Putin is allowing some movement of product through the straits in the Black Sea. Well, how is that causing such an increase in price for commodities when he's allowing some movement of product?
Well, my understanding is one of the big deficits is that Ukraine raises about 30% of the wheat grown on Earth. And then you've got the United States where the wheat crop, the net crop at the end of this summer is already forecast to be about 8% low. Now, ordinarily, an 8% deficit could be covered by buying from other countries. But if all that grain that's in Ukraine that would ordinarily go to Western Europe, to other parts of that part of the world, and even to the United States, if that's all locked up, if fertilizer is locked up, and we're not growing as much wheat this year, Ukraine and its wheat is locked up, you're going to end up with shortages. And I think people should take this seriously. Be ready for you to go to the grocery store. Americans, I don't think have ever, not since World War II, have we had people go to the grocery store and have them tell us, we're just out and we don't know when we're going to get more. But we've had little bites of that kind of problem over the last 2 years where you order a part for something and they say, yeah, it's going to be 6 months. 6 months in this day and age? Jason, people should take these possible food shortages, which have been forecast for a few months now, and then add in everything you're seeing with your own eyes. Don't listen to Joe, because Joe will be telling you about this fall when things really start to run short. He's going to say, oh, don't worry, it's just temporary, because that's his way of kicking the can down the road. But that's how you create a shortage, because, Jason, you don't have to lose all of your supply of something to run. You know, in other words, if a store normally sells 100 units of something, whatever it is, and all of a sudden they're getting, and then every week they get 100 units delivered. And then 1 week the truck comes in with 75 items on it. And you say, hold on, that you're only 25% short. it creates massive, it can create massive shortages, and that's going to be a problem. Let's go to Karen. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Well, I want to call you in about the sun, the electromagnetic pulse, but briefly on the wheat shortage. You know, I found out that, this is about corn, the amount of corn that it takes to fill an SUV once with ethanol gas would feed a man for a year. We need to stop putting corn in cars and put it in people. And so the EMP shield, I bought an EMP shield. I have it on my circuit breaker for my house and one on my car. Because my bigger fear is somebody, one of our, quote, friends, blowing a nuclear bomb up in the atmosphere.
Yeah, the kind that
and,
would put off an EMP.
Literally wipe it out. And Dr. Peter Price says that in a first year, 90% of Americans will die if that.
If that happened, if we had an EMP, whether from natural causes or from an attack, think North Korea, you could end up wiping out a lot of people. Refrigeration goes and everything else. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And as you know, on this program, naysayers go to the head of the line, although we haven't had any naysayers recently. Maybe they just lost their nerve or something. So many things are going south on them. I got up this morning early and got cleaned up, and then I put on my one of my favorite Second Amendment shirts, not knowing that the U.S. Supreme Court was going to come down with a hugely consequential decision, although it seemed like kind of an obvious one to me. New York City had told its citizens for years, if you want to have your Second Amendment rights, you can have them in your house or in your apartment or your condo or your co-op, but you can't carry your gun outside. No, to get that, you need a big pile of money and or big political connections. Otherwise, you can't have a carry permit. That went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has said, hey, New York, that's unconstitutional. Knock it off. And of course, the liberals are going absolutely crazy. So I thought I'd talk to Tom Gipping, who's deputy director of the Ed Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and a senior legal fellow at Heritage about this. Tom, I hope you don't take this personally, that I would rather talk to somebody from Everytown or one of the rabidly anti-gun groups, but they won't talk to me, Tom. So I thought I'd talk to you and get you to give my audience an idea of where this takes us now.
Sure, and I would gladly step aside if that opportunity presented itself, but as with the upcoming decision regarding abortion, liberals, you know, they say that they object to the decision, but they never point to where in the actual opinion explaining that decision there is a problem. Look, Justice Thomas in the decision today pointed out that both sides agree that the Second Amendment gives you the right to possess a firearm for self-defense, even outside the home. What makes this New York law unique, I think only five or six states try to do this, is that they make you not only meet certain objective criteria for a license, but they make you prove that you must, that you have a, quote, special need for a firearm for self-defense. Well, it's not a right if you have to convince some public official that you have a special need for it. Imagine if we did that for the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment, or imagine for the liberals, what if they did that with abortion? That you have to prove
imagine
you have a
that.
Special need. I mean, liberals would go absolutely insane. So it was a very common sense, straightforward decision. A right is a right. Second Amendment gives law-abiding citizens the right to possess a handgun for self-defense, and you don't have to make some special showing to some bureaucrat to exercise that right.
I'm talking to Tom Gipping from the Heritage Foundation. So, Tom, it turns out that the very thing the libs thought was going to give them the greatest justification to argue for more gun laws actually worked against them, because didn't the court members in this big opinion, and, you know, they had concurring affirmations of the majorities who wrote different opinions, but they said, look, Buffalo, New York just had a shooting, and clearly the restrictions on guns in New York did not constrain the killer in that case one little bit.
Well, that's a good example of where, in addition to is this a right or isn't it, you have the practical question of which is really more of a policy-oriented question, and that is, do any of these gun control ideas, and the same ones come up all the time, do any of them have any hope of improving the situation? And the New York State and Buffalo is the clearest example where they have those laws. It's not just, there's not speculation about what if they did. They have those laws. And obviously they don't stop these kinds of shootings. Again, law-abiding citizens have a Second Amendment right to possess a firearm for self-defense. That's been true since before the Second Amendment was even part of the Constitution. I really want to emphasize what the court did, which is this right of self-defense predates the Constitution. It's even more important than rights that appeared for the first time in our Constitution. And this isn't the first time the Supreme Court has said so. This time they said, and we mean it.
And by the way, Tom, one of the things that's getting under my skin already, in the last couple of hours, I've seen headlines that say Supreme Court expands gun rights of Americans. Now, I think it's a know-nothing headline writer, but they didn't expand anything. All the court said was, you've always had that right, and New York unconstitutionally restricted it. Am I right?
That's right. Any court and the Supreme Court, I think Justice Thomas explained it in his opinion today, they do two things when they have a decision like this. They interpret and they apply, whether it's the Constitution or a statute. The interpretation of the Constitution is fixed. The application to different circumstances is what it can be more challenging. That's what the court did today. They didn't change the meaning of the Second Amendment. They didn't change the breadth of the right that you and I have to defend ourselves, but they applied it to the particular law in New York State that require that where the government really decides whether you have a need to exercise your Second Amendment right. That's what the media gets wrong, and that's why you see misleading headlines like that.
Tom, let me ask you a question. When they decided gay marriage, the so-called Obergefell decision, my recollection is within either hours or at most a day or two, there were gay marriages happening in all these states around America where it was illegal up until Obergefell was decided. It might have even been the same day. Now, in this case, when the court says to New York, you have unconstitutionally constrained the civil rights of your citizens, do we see the same kind of instantaneous reaction that citizens can now go to the state of New York today or tomorrow and say, hey, I want a permit and I no longer have to show you a need?
Well, we'll see. I mean, remember in the civil rights movement, after Brown versus Board of Education, a lot of schools in the South and states in the South found ways of dragging their feet and still resisting, you know, recognizing people's rights. You can bet that liberals, especially those in states like New York, are going to do everything they can to prevent people from exercising the right that the Supreme Court today vindicated. And that's why, you know, we have to be thankful to those organizations and plaintiffs who are willing to step up and go all the way to the Supreme Court, because they're defending the rights of all of us.
Well, I heard Eric Adams, this joker who's the mayor of New York, saying, well, we've got to prevent this from becoming the wild, wild west. I'll tell you what, Tim, I live out west, and while it's not the most conservative place in the world, we have fairly good laws on concealed carry, and not a week goes by when you don't hear about a homeowner killing somebody who came to the house to rob or hurt that person, and yeah, and they're justifiable. So I'm kind of hoping, I hope that in New York City, honest law-abiding citizens arm themselves up, and when somebody tries to mug them, you get the first half dozen or dozen dead bad guys on the ground, and that actually will have a positive effect for everybody else, whether you carry a gun or not, won't it?
Well, if what he means is, you know, we're going to have people just shooting each other and, you know, have all kinds of violence, sorry, we're already there in New York. And they've got a rogue prosecutor, district attorney in New York City, who's refusing to enforce all kinds of laws. People in New York ought to do what the people in San Francisco did with their rogue prosecutor and get rid of them. So
couldn't agree more. You know, couldn't agree more. And by the way, I'd put that Manhattan DA on about the same par as George Gascon, who I think is going to be off with Chesa Boudin looking for a job here real soon. That's Thomas Jipping, the legal fellow of the Heritage Foundation, deputy director of the Ed Meese Center. Back in a moment. I'll get to your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you get to pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Our Twitter poll today, should elected county sheriffs refuse to enforce red flag laws? You know, a moment ago I had a naysayer on the line, and he dropped off the line because I wanted to hear his argument against this. I mean, I think that if you went to anybody in law enforcement and you ask them, if you've taken an oath, especially as a county sheriff directly elected by the voters, not a police chief who's hired by a bunch of politicians, he doesn't really answer the voters, he answers the politicians. But if you went to that county sheriff and said, if the county or the city or the state put a law on the books that you honestly believe is unconstitutional, would you go ahead and enforce the law anyway? I think in a lot of ways that's comparable to going to a member of the military, like Lieutenant William Calley back in the Vietnam days, and saying, if your superior officer gives you an order, will you follow it? Yes. If your superior officer gives you an order that you know is illegal, will you follow it? And that became the big debate over the My Lai massacre was, do you have a right as a member of the military to say, sir, you're asking me to do something that is illegal. You're asking me to murder this person. I will not do it. Now, you have to be confident that when you get hauled up in front of a court or other superior officers, that you're going to be able to convince them that it was illegal as well, because otherwise you're going to be in a big bunch of trouble. Let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, you think the Supreme Court got today's ruling wrong? Welcome to the show, and tell me why.
Well, no, Lars, I'm not saying the court got it wrong. I'm saying that a lot of your callers are getting the premise of the decision wrong. So in the way I'm looking at this is basically the decision turned states like New York, New Jersey, California into shall issue states. Right. And that's all it did. I see a lot of people saying, well, this means open carry or what? No, it's just a shall issue for permits. But what it doesn't do is keep these states from saying, okay, now you're going to have to take a class. We can charge you $1,000 for a class, and we can charge you $5,000 for the permit.
I
know
agree.
That's ridiculous, and I'm just spitballing here.
Well, but no, I know that's true. Jim, they'll throw up roadblocks, but this is a gain anyway because you no longer have to prove you need to have the permit. Now, you're right. A state can say, we're going to have to take a bunch of classes. It'll cost you a lot of money. It's going to take you a lot of time. And there are a number of jurisdictions like Washington, D.C. that do exactly that. They say it'll take you roughly a year and a couple of $1,000s to get a permit to carry a gun. It's still a move forward because it's the Supreme Court recognizing, you know, Heller recognized you have an individual right to own a gun. But then all these states that effectively said, well, yeah, you can own a gun, but you can only own it in your house. This takes us outside the house and says you have a right to have a gun and you have a right to carry it outside the house. So that's a move forward, isn't
cost?
It? Well,
absolutely, it's a move forward. You know, I come up to Washington every August and take the boat out to get out of the heat down here. And I got pulled over 2 years ago by a Washington State Patrol trooper, and I had the Arizona permit. I let my Washington permit expire. And he asked to see my permit. He asked me if I had any guns in the car. And I said, yeah, I showed him the Arizona permit. He says, you know, we don't take that here
recognize
in Washington.
It.
Although
yep,
Arizona honors Washington's. Yeah. But when he said, you got guns in the car? I said, yeah, of course I do. Doesn't everybody? He says, all right, have a nice day. And just walk off.
Which so, is a good, you know, that's a good thing, right?
It's an absolutely good thing. I'm just saying that now I think the problem with these poor people in Arizona, or not Arizona, but Hawaii, California, New Jersey, New York, I think it's going to be so expensive that they're not going to be able to afford it. So it's going to go back to being, hey, whose campaign did you contribute to like they do in California in order for us to give you a permit?
And I think so you're right about that, Jim. If I had my druthers right now, by my count, there are 15 states with constitutional carry. Two of them only only have, meaning you don't need a permit as long as you're legally able to own a gun. You're not a convicted felon. You haven't been to the loony bin and you're not a domestic abuser. You can have, you can carry a gun and you don't need a state card. I wish we could get all the states there. We're about a, we're almost a third of the way there, but it's going to, I mean, imagine California or New York or Washington or Oregon going to constitutional carry. It's rather hard to imagine in the current political environment, isn't it?
Yeah, probably not in my lifetime.
No, but at least we've moved that direction. I mean, Jim, you go back a few decades, very few states had concealed carry permits, and most of them were not shall issue, meaning, and just so people understand, the term of art is shall issue means that if you walk in and say, I want a permit, and you meet the legal qualifications, they have to give you a permit. New York stopped that by saying, well, you meet the legal qualifications, but now you have to convince us, your government masters, that you have the right to carry a gun or that you have a need to carry a gun. And that got thrown out today. And God bless the Supreme Court and God bless Donald Trump's three picks. Let's go to Henry in Bellingham. Henry, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I'm a naysayer today for sure.
So, oh, boy. And we're close to the break. So tell me what you're naysaying on. We may hold you over to another segment. What do we disagree about?
That would be great. So you were talking about the January 6th commission. You specifically said that we've gotten no new information since January 6th of 2021.
No, I said the committee has given most of this is a rehash of everything we've heard over the last year and a half. What's new?
That's inaccurate.
What's new?
Joe Barr was not deposed in January of 2021.
No, but tell me, Henry, when we're close to the break, tell me what you got out that's new.
Oh, so Bill Barr said that Donald Trump knew that he lost under oath.
Knew what?
He knew, Donald Trump knew that he lost the election.
Well, so Bill Barr is giving an opinion of what another man knew. Okay. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and you're welcome to call into the show. If you're a naysayer, you'll go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can remember that is 866-HEY-LARS. You can send me emails, talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll, and today's Twitter poll reads this way. Should elected county sheriffs refuse to enforce red flag laws because they are clearly unconstitutional? Or would you tell an elected county sheriff, doesn't matter if it's constitutional, just go ahead and arrest people or take their guns away? I don't think that makes much sense, which kind of puts Congress's action on a gun bill in an entirely different light, since the red flag laws are a big part of that. But I want to talk about something that you could view as a conspiracy. Can you imagine if an institution called the public schools, run by the government, that on which we spend tens of billions of dollars, and they say, we will educate your kids. In fact, unless you provide some other kind of education for them, they are required to be sitting in a classroom in a public school from kindergarten to 12th grade. And then when the schools say, you know, we've got some really lousy graduation rates, is there any way we can fix this? And they decide to fix it by just changing the grades. Lieve Finna is the director of the Center for Education of the Washington Policy Center. Lieve, welcome back to the program, and tell me what the folks in North Shore School District near Seattle, tell me what they've done to try to, I guess, just fix the whole game.
Well, it's a disgrace. They have decided to lower academic learning standards there by giving, by making it unallowed, by disallowing teachers from giving students a failing grade, meaning they've passed a resolution that all children will pass. The lowest grade that a child can get in North Shore is a D. And, you know, this is part of the aftermath of the COVID school shutdown. A lot of the children are not up to par, and the schools want to present high graduation rates. Remember, these kids are just graduating, some of them, and they can't graduate if they don't pass certain classes. And so what they've done is lowered the standard for passing the classes.
So a passing grade is now a D, but leave. I know you've attributed it to the pandemic, but is it fair to say, since you've been following this a long time, the schools have had failure when it comes to graduation rates long before COVID arrived on our shores from China, didn't they?
Yes. Yes, that is true. That is true. For a long time, the students in Washington State have not passed the state tests in English and math, yet our graduation rates are in the 80% rate. That's still not very good. That still means that 20% are failing. But of the 80% that are passing, they're not all meeting the minimum set by the state in terms of skills and knowledge in math and English. So this just sets them up for failure after high school. And this has been a long-term trend. It's just that now we're actually seeing union agreements, memorandum of understanding passed in North Shore, one of the better school districts north of Seattle, saying that no child in 6th through 12th grade can get a failing grade, which is, of course, the losers in this are the children and the taxpayers of Washington State.
And the communities. Because leave.
And the community.
So we literally have, because you and I both talked about unions, I'm not a fan. I don't think you are either, especially in the way that they adversely affect education. But in this case, the unions actually went in and used their muscle to get the school district to say, we will call a D a passing grade. And in fact, we'll call Fs Ds, right?
Yes. They're calling Fs no credits. And then the kids, in order to earn the credit, can go to summer school and get a credit to pass the class, you see, and that's a lower level standard. So
even if they no, but this is that true? Even if they fail the class, so they get an F, and they say you have to go to summer school. They go to summer school and they get an F again, but the lowest they can get is a D, which means technically they passed. Have I got any of that wrong?
I think that's correct. I mean, they no longer give an F; they give a no credit. Send the kid to a class to make up that credit, and they can't give an F. So there you are.
And by the way, Leave, let's remind people, the McCleary decision said under the Washington State Constitution that the public was obligated to adequately fund education. And that created, would you mind reminding me or remind the audience, over the last decade or so, how much have we increased spending on public education?
Well, we have gone in the last 10 years from $10,000 per student on average statewide to $18,175 per student on average statewide, which means that rich districts like Seattle's are spending $22,000 per student on children's education. And we're basically, the McCleary decision basically forced the taxpayers of Washington State to write a blank check to an institution that is demonstrably failed during COVID and is not passing adequate numbers of children and getting them ready for their lives after high school. I mean, the state test last fall showed that 70% of the students are failing in math. Failing in math. 70% of the students of Washington State have failed the state math test. And you know what that means. If you don't have adequate skills in math, you cannot gain, you know, an entrance to a good college or a good trade school for that matter.
You can't get a good job. Can you get a good job at Starbucks making change if you can't do math?
No.
I mean,
can you
be a good carpenter if you can't do math? I mean, imagine a carpenter trying to do his job with the math that's involved in that. We're not talking about just college. So, Leave, if I sum it up this way, we had failing public schools a decade ago. Funding was increased 80% from $10,000 a year to $18,000 a year. The schools are still failing, and the school teachers union has gone in and said, let's use COVID as an excuse for why this is happening, even though it was happening long before COVID, and let's redefine a passing grade as D but also make a rule that say, even if you get an F, you still get a D, you still pass, you still graduate, so we can tell the public, we're doing our job, you gave us 80% more money, most of it went into salaries, and we're doing the job right, even though we know for a fact they're not. Is that right?
Yes, that is, it is unfortunately right, and we have to do better for the sake of the children than this, than continuing to fund a system that is failing our kids so badly. They're experts at papering over their failure, and this is just one of the many ways they do it.
Is the community, the North Shore community, are they speaking up and saying, hey, we're getting ripped off six ways from Sunday for our kids, for everything else? Are they objecting?
Yes, there's it's caused quite a ruckus in the North Shore community. You know, I got this information from teachers, you know, who told me this was going on, because many teachers are dismayed by this trend in lowering academic learning standards naturally, because it makes their jobs less relevant and less impactful. Teachers need to have the tools that we give them to grade students so they can get the best out of the children. And they are upset by this. And the community, of course, they buy homes in this district to send their kids to a good school. And they see that the kids are being socially promoted and graduating from high school without what they were promised.
Exactly right. That's Lee Fenner from the Washington Policy Center. Back in a moment, we'll talk oil and old Joe.
Would there be any place for fossil fuels, including coal and fracking, in a Biden administration?
No, we would work it out. We would make sure it's eliminated.
No more drilling on federal lands. No more drilling, including offshore. No ability for the oil industry to continue to drill, period.
I guarantee you, we're going to end fossil fuel.
What about, say, stopping fracking and stopping new pipeline infrastructure?
Yes. New pipeline.
No more, no new fracking.
We are going to get rid of fossil fuels.
I've argued against any more oil drilling or gas drilling on federal lands.
No one's going to build a coal-fired plant again, and we're going to get rid of the ones we have now.
Have a transition from the oil industry, yes.
Would you be willing to sacrifice some of that growth, even knowing potentially that it could displace thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of blue-collar workers, in the interest of transitioning to that greener economy?
The answer is yes.
Now, that is Joe Biden when he was a candidate for president. Yeah, we're going to get rid of the oil industry. And now that gasoline has hit a price that is, well, it just dipped right below $5 nationwide average per gallon, and diesel's north of $6 a gallon, and all of a sudden Joe Biden has a political problem, and he's begging just about everybody around the world, except, of course, American companies, to drill for more oil, produce more oil. He's telling the oil companies, you've got to refine more gasoline and diesel. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here. In fact, we're going to talk to a naysayer here in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. I'm glad to have you with me, and if you want to send me an email, talk@LarsLarson.com is where you go. If you want to vote in our Twitter poll, it's @LarsLarsonShow. And then this week, Joe Biden decides, well, I'm in trouble on gas prices and diesel prices. My party is going to lose the House and the Senate, and we're already on track to lose the presidential election, and that's 2.5 years away. What are we going to do about this? So Joe comes out and says, how about a 90-day suspension of the federal gas tax? As I've said all along, both when we expected him to do it and when he finally did it yesterday, that is, he did it in the sense that he asked the Congress, and there's no guarantee the Congress is going to go along with it. I said, well, look, I don't want to turn down any help to Americans who are paying these punishing prices right now. But if 18 cents a gallon reduction is going to do the trick, I don't think that's the case either. But like you said, any little bit might help. Well, it turns out that even his friends, his closest political allies, believe this is ridiculous. Barack Obama said, for us to suggest a little bit of relief for 3 months is real relief. We're not tackling the problem. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, very showbiz, okay? Let's just do something. There it is. But it's not necessarily landing in the pocket of the consumer. Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader, I've not been a proponent of a gas tax holiday. I don't know that it gives much relief. Joe Manchin, skeptical. Tom Carper, short-sighted and inefficient. Richie Neal, representative in the House. There's no guarantee that any sort of suspension of the gas tax will be passed on to consumers. And he was asked, is the savings really going to flow to the consumers? Peter DeFazio, member of Congress, although he's quitting at the end of his term, suspending the federal gas tax will not provide meaningful relief. And then when it comes to his energy secretary, Jennifer Granholm, she proves once again there's a reason we say she's not the sharpest tool in the shed. Take a listen. Now, we'll get to that soundbite a little bit later. And it's not just the Democrats who've come out against Joe Biden's gas tax. Okay, run the Granholm bite, please.
The national security, the energy security implications of Putin's war cannot be overstated. The geopolitical realignments that are happening as a result are momentous. So it is a really turbulent time for all of us, but we have to stay focused because these crises have a common solution, of course, which is clean energy.
Now, does anybody think that green energy, that is the energy secretary of the United States of America, that, you know, next week or next month or even next year, that you're going to be able to drive a car fueled by the sun or fueled by the wind? Everybody knows that is not going to, it may happen eventually in decades. The numbers don't add up to it. 500,000 electric cars sold last year and 16 or 17 million gasoline and diesel cars. And the energy secretary of the United States doesn't seem to understand that. And then there are the other Democrat politicians, Obama's economist, Jason Furman. Whatever you thought of the merits of a gas tax holiday in February, it is a worse idea now. Harvard economist Peter Blair, bad idea. Obama's Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, no fan of the gas tax holiday. That's a gimmick. And NBC's Chuck Todd, Obama once called the gas tax holiday a gimmick. Why is this not a gimmick now? It's still a gimmick. It's trying to say, can we do something to make sure that every Democrat does not lose his run for re-election? Well, no, there doesn't appear to be much they can do. Everybody's saying it's a gimmick. Now, on that note, I want to get back to a naysayer. Henry, welcome to the program. You and I disagree about the January 6th committee. I think it's a big dog and pony show and a rehash. You say there's something important coming out of it. What is important that's coming out of the January 6th committee?
Sure. Thanks, Lars. So the new information that's coming out are depositions that were conducted under oath. And you said there was no new information coming out, and that's not accurate. Bill Barr gave a deposition under oath where he claimed that he told Donald Trump with no uncertainty that he lost the election. Ivanka Trump gave a deposition under
oath. Hold on. Let's stop on that one first, Henry. Henry, can we stop on that one first? So you ask somebody under oath for their opinion, and they give their opinion. What kind of evidence is that? Everybody's got an opinion, usually more than one. What difference does it make if somebody gives an opinion under oath? Does an opinion under oath have any more weight than any other opinion?
It wasn't an opinion. It was a statement, and yes, it does.
No, hold on, Henry. Do you understand who Bill Barr is? Bill Barr was the attorney general. Hold on. He was the attorney. He's not. Bill, Henry.
What I do is political.
Henry, hold up, Henry. Yeah. Bill Barr was the attorney general. He's not a judge. He's not the Supreme Court. This is not a ruling. If you go to any lawyer and say, what's your opinion of this? You can have a lawyer says that's legal. You have another lawyer says it's not legal. What does an opinion from Bill Barr mean in the way of new information?
You know, Lars, you talk about double standards quite a bit. And I recall when Bill Barr was giving opinions on the Mueller investigation, you were on board 100% with those.
No, I think his opinion was right, but it's still just an opinion, isn't it? No, but Henry, when I ask you new information, if I ask you about information in your life, if I said, do you want to buy a new car? And you said, well, maybe I do, maybe I don't. That's an opinion, all right? If I say, do you own a car? And you say, I own a car. That's a provable fact that you can either say, I own a car or I don't own a car. That's fact. What factual information have we received that's new about what happened on January 6th a year and a half ago?
That Bill Barr told Donald Trump he lost the election and there was no evidence.
So he gave Donald Trump an opinion. Well, big deal. Everybody's, I've got an opinion. If I give you an opinion and I say I think November 3rd was a fraudulent election, if I gave that opinion under oath, would it have any more weight? Of course not. It's an opinion. Now, do I try to back the opinion up with something? Of course I do. Henry, decent naysayer anyway, not stellar. 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Always glad to get your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Should a religious school be forced to support groups within that school that are actually working in contravention to the religious beliefs of a private religious school? I thought we'd talk about this issue, and it's an interesting one, with Rabbi Yaakov Menken, who's managing director of the Coalition for Jewish Values, the largest rabbinic public policy organization in America. Rabbi Yaakov, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Would you mind telling me what's, and my audience, what's going on at Yeshiva University in New York City?
Well, Yeshiva University just got a judgment against them, of course, from a particular judge in the New York State system that said, responding to a lawsuit from a group that wished to form as an officially recognized student group at Yeshiva University as an LGBTQ club. Now, of course, Yeshiva University, being a Jewish rabbinic school or associated with rabbinic school, is obviously of the Jewish religious variety. But nonetheless, back in 1970, they chartered themselves as a secular school in order to receive certain funding the government will only give to schools it deems secular, which, if you're watching, you know, just a week ago, or yep, a few days ago, actually, the Supreme Court declared potentially unconstitutional. So I don't think, in Yeshiva University's defense, I don't think that they even imagined in 1970 what being secular would entail in 2022. I don't think they could possibly have foreseen that. But the dean of the rabbinic school associated with it said with some prescience in 1970 that this is a really bad idea.
He did. So he anticipated that this might be the result, that when you start taking money from the government and you promise we're going to be a secular school, that you could end up with problems. The thing I don't understand is why would somebody whose life, you know, the way they conduct their life is not in accord with the religious beliefs of a school, why would they want to be a student or a teacher or in any other way associated with a school if the school doesn't hew to the same values they do? I've never understood that.
Yeah, my son did not think about applying to Baylor University. You've got a point.
Well, and, you know, Rabbi, there was a case, I don't know, about a decade ago, there was a lesbian couple. Fine, okay, it's their life. I'm not running their life. I don't want the government to run their life either. They wanted to put their kids in a Catholic school. And then they complained that the Catholic school said, we don't approve of your lifestyle. You're a couple. You're a lesbian couple. And I wondered, well, if you're a lesbian couple and you understand the Catholic Church is, you know, you love all the sinners, but you don't love the sin, and you can say we disapprove of your lifestyle. You knew that when you walked in the door. Why did you come to a place that you knew was somewhat antithetical to the way you conduct your life? Why not go to any other school that you could go to? And of course, they brought a lawsuit demanding that the religious school change its practices rather than simply self-select and go to a different school.
There are really only two options here for the students at Yeshiva University who did this. One is that throughout high school, in the middle of pride parades and all the celebration of this lifestyle that's going on right now, they had absolutely no clue that they were gay as they went through puberty and adolescence and checking out everybody and et cetera, which means that it's not at all the innate character trait, the element of a person's identity that they claim it to be. That's simply not the case. It's a choice, it's a desire, it's something that arises in people, but it's not an identity characteristic which completely contradicts the entire message. Okay, that's possibility number one.
Right.
Possibility number two is that they went to Yeshiva University with an agenda to force a Yeshiva University to say there should be no refuge from this nonsense. No, there cannot be any place in America outside perhaps a house of worship where you're allowed to say, we don't believe in your lifestyle. You have to have it, even at Yeshiva University. So either they say it's not an innate characteristic at all, or they went there to celebrate their agenda and with an axe to grind. And by the way, the fact that the judge is herself a member of the LGBTQ Law Council of New York and got a coveted, highly approved rating, and rare highly approved rating, from LGBTQ New York Vote, that kind of tells you something.
Well, and Rabbi, it seems to invite kind of what I think what the lawyers call a moral hazard. You've now created an opportunity, and I would compare it to this, although it's not in the religious lane. If I went to a bunch of my conservative friends and said, let's get a few million of us, let's join the Sierra Club and turn it into the biggest advocacy group for drilling for oil in America. And they'd say, well, why would you go to a group that doesn't believe in drilling for oil and want to change them? You say, because then I'll basically wipe them out as what they are, what the Sierra Club, you know, stands for. I'm not a member of the Sierra Club, obviously. But why would I want to do that? So that I can destroy other institutions that are part of people's beliefs, if not closely held religious beliefs, then at least philosophical beliefs, and say, we're going to have these marauding bands of people running around saying, let's get into an organization and we'll change the nature of the organization where we're all done. We can walk away and leave the wreckage behind us. That's what it seems like to me. It invites that kind of behavior, doesn't it?
It is a mob mentality. It is dominating the left. It is this concept. I mean, of course, as a Jewish person who cares about Israel, you kind of reminded me of this so-called idea of a Palestinian right of return, which is that any Arab whose great-great-great-grandparents ever step foot in British Mandatory Palestine has a right to live in Israel, which, of course, means we demographically overwhelm the Jews, and presto, we don't have a Jewish state anymore. We have no opportunity for anybody else who's different. Well, that's exactly what they're trying to do to the school here, and that's what you see the left doing in America and many other areas. What you just described regarding Sierra Club, I don't think that's such a theoretical. We've seen organizations taken over by woke radicals that didn't start off that way, who have living donors who say, why did I ever give this organization a penny when this is what they're supporting now?
I've noticed that, too, because, Rabbi, I have some friends whose families have given a lot of money to foundations and such, and they say, why is this foundation so different? You know, in other words, if the people who founded and gave the money to start it and the people who continue to support it, why is it so liberal and left? And you say, because they, you know, what happens is they, the other side, comes in, takes over, and says, we don't like the philosophy of this organization, so we're going to change it. Well, why not just start your own organization? They say, well, we already have LGBT organizations. We want to take over all the other ones. And I've got gay friends who say they hate what this whole LGBT crowd is doing. They resent the idea. Just because you're gay, you say, well, these people represent you. No, they don't. And they behave in ways that actually bring shame and disrepute on the people who just want to be gay Americans. Who cares, right?
There are people who just want to do their private business in their private time and really would rather not. And by the way, there's a whole lot of gay Americans who object specifically to the trans agenda because a lot of the trans, specifically trans men to women, actually despise real natural women. They call them TERFs if they dare to disagree.
Unbelievable. That's Rabbi Yaakov Menken. He's the managing director of the Coalition for Jewish Values. Rabbi, it's always good to have you on the program. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your calls. And if you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Call 811 Before You Dig. Whether it's in your yard or in the field, call 811 to know what's below things. things like gas lines and electric lines and that sort of thing. Or you can go to digsafelyoregon.com for details, or the Washington or Idaho equivalents. Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And our Twitter poll today: should elected county sheriffs refuse to enforce red flag laws? I point to the one example. The Cibola County Sheriff, this is in New Mexico, Tony Mace, said, somebody hasn't even committed a crime and you're taking their personal property? No, I'm not going to enforce that law. I'd love to see the sheriffs in Oregon and Washington and Idaho, where there are red flag laws, simply tell us, if you believe that this is an unconstitutional taking, as in, we're told that no man or woman's life, liberty, or property may be taken without due process and just compensation. Can't be taken by the government without due process. Red flag laws can only work in theory if you violate the person's due process rights. So I would say the elected sheriff should refuse to enforce those laws. The Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. I want to tell you something. I get so many emails. Let me start, though, first with Bellevue. And I want to mention this because this is one of those strange situations. There's a relatively conservative columnist named Danny Westneed who works for the Seattle Times. I don't know him personally, but I read some of what he writes. And he had one today where he said, history is repeating itself. Now Bellevue is talking about taxing Amazon as well. Amazon, the big company that's based mostly in Seattle, although now they're starting to set up headquarters elsewhere. And they're even starting to move a lot of their, well, they're not move, but locate some of their employees in places like Bellevue. And I share his concerns. While I don't think he's as conservative as I am, he's talking about the fact that Seattle has threatened Amazon. A couple of years ago, just about the time that the pandemic was arriving and just about the time that the CHOP zone was being established on Capitol Hill in Seattle, the Seattle City Council, with a bunch of lunatic lefty socialists on it, said, we're going to tax Amazon. And they crafted a tax that was aimed almost exclusively at Amazon. And Amazon, which had on the books plans to build 24 huge buildings in Seattle that were planned for the company, announced, you know what, we're on building 12 or 13 or 14. That's all we're going to build here. We're going to build elsewhere. And they were going to finish out the building they were working on. In fact, the building was the subject of some of the protests in favor of big taxes on Amazon. So now Amazon takes the message. Oh, we're not welcome here in Seattle anymore? Okay, we'll move some people or establish some other locations in places like Bellevue. And now Bellevue, which Westneed points out, has in the last year seen $1.4 billion in new development plans, not just from Amazon, but other companies as well. And you would think that most cities would say, a big company wants to come and build here. They want to build skyscrapers here. And what's that going to do to everybody else? It's going to raise property values. It's going to raise property taxes. It's going to bring in a lot of new business. And when some bigger companies locate here, smaller companies will say, well, this is going to be an attractive place. We want to be near where all of that is going on. And now Bellevue is saying, apparently, according to Westneed, they're saying, hey, we're going to start taxing the daylights out of these people. It's almost like that story you heard as a kid about the golden goose, you know, the guy who finds the golden goose and it lays a golden egg every day. And he's prosperous because he's getting all this. And then his family gets greedy and they say, hey, why don't we cut the goose open and we'll find out where the eggs are coming from. And then we'll have a whole pile of golden eggs. And they find out that the goose could have kept on laying a golden egg every day. And you just sit back and be patient and it comes to you. Instead, you cut the animal open. It doesn't lay eggs anymore. It's dead. And it's not full of golden eggs. There's a reason that parents tell their kids that story. Because the idea is that if you've got a good thing going, why not take advantage of the good thing and try to enhance it? If Bellevue all of a sudden finds out that it's a place that people are attracted to as they're running away from the tax and regulatory and crime environment of Seattle, why don't you enhance that? Instead, Westneed makes a good point. that when Bellevue says, hey, Seattle managed to scare a lot of its businesses away, and some of them are coming to our town. So why don't we do the same thing Seattle's doing and scare the businesses away? This is the kind of thing that's not just been done here in the Northwest. It's being done all over America. You have big companies and people say, well, how dare those companies move to Mexico or go off to China or other places like that? You say, well, why are they leaving? Do they really want to leave the United States? I have yet to talk to a single CEO of a big company that says, I really want to move my company out of America. What happens instead is they say, I have a successful company, and now that my success is big enough, the people in charge have decided that they want to do things to the company I run that will make it unattractive to stay here. And in some cases, the companies do exactly what is happening in Bellevue and Seattle. I'll give you the example that three major companies, including Caterpillar Tractor, that has been in Peoria, Illinois forever, they are now moving to Texas. You say, why would they move from a liberal state like Illinois to a state like Texas? Ask Elon Musk, because Texas made itself an attractive business environment, and Illinois and places like Seattle and Portland have made themselves unattractive. And you've got the Lars Larson Show.